talking about the little small race riots like Spring Valley 1895, which is, of course, related to labor. I'm not talking about Painter and Virden 1898, which was, of course, labor disputes. I'm talking about the big ones. Mm-hmm. Springfield 1908, East St. Louis 1917, Chicago 1919. Mm-hmm. So Illinois was a very anti-black, deeply racist and violent state. Yet it was seen by African Americans as the promised land.
Yes.
Right? Chicago has been called the Mecca. Now, the only way you can get that is to understand how bad it had to be in the South, right? So we have to get to Nina Simone's song, Mississippi Goddamn. Oh, I can't say that.
That's okay.
I think that's okay,
man. Yeah, your quote, your title and song. Okay.
We've actually said worse.
That's okay. We just keep rolling. Okay.
So you got Rosewood, 1921. Mm-hmm. Then you got Tulsa, Oklahoma, where literally in Tulsa, 1921, you got a phenomenon where the African Blood Brotherhood, the first black socialist organization, literally is defending the African-American community because they're a paramilitary organization. Whites, on the other hand, are in planes that they used to use to crop desks. They're dropping incendiary devices on the black community. That's how Black Wall Street is burned in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm. Right? So, yeah, it's interesting. Aerial bombing.
Yeah, aerial bombing in the U.S. So that, you know, speaks to that moment, right? But what comes out of that, right, is that African Americans transformed themselves from a population that was probably more than 90% Southern, more than 90% rural, into a population that is urban, right, Northern, a population in which as late as 1910, 60% of black men were in agriculture, right? As late as 1910, probably more than 60% of black women were in agriculture. Well, actually, no, 52% of black women were involved in agriculture. To a population in which African Americans became wage workers, proletarians, right? And that's a tremendous transformation. And one of the keys to understand it is that there were so many strikes in the South. Elaine, Arkansas, major strike where the sharecroppers went on strike to get a dollar a day. You got to think about this now.
And this is
getting,
what?
They were getting 75 cents.
And this is what year?
This is 1917.
1917. So
yeah, 1915.
Yeah, a dollar a day would be like maybe $20 a day now, possibly. I mean, you know, just a rough.
Yeah, something astronomical. But we don't need to go to the contemporary moment. What we need to understand is this: that working in that Southern plantation economy as sharecroppers, African Americans tended to make about $3.50 a week, right? But you had to, but they probably picked, right, on average, close to 250 pounds of cotton a day per individual. Okay? It made 75 cents. Now, in the North, right, as the Ford Motor Company got to going, you could make $5 a day. Both situations, you work 6 days a week. So now we're talking about, $30 a week in the North versus, 15?
Yeah.
Okay? So you double your income, right? Your kids can go to school, right? Coming out of that sharecropping economy, you went to school when there was no work to be done. So I grew up in Decatur, just west. When I was growing up, probably more than half of the black population came from one county in Tennessee, Haywood County. Haywood County was the prime cotton-producing county in Tennessee from the period of slavery into the 1960s. When a kid came up, if they were 12 and you think they'd be in the sixth grade, they came up out of Haywood County, they went to the fifth or the fourth grade. Right, and that's because of the nature of that plantation economy, which locked people right in uneducated situations. So when you start beginning to multiply the impact of what it meant to leave that Southern plantation economy and those social relations of oppression that were attendant to it, and you move into the urban environment in the North. Now, it's not that the Northern environment isn't racist, right? It's not that it isn't oppressive. Of course it is, but it's differently so. Right, and black people have different capacities. They have greater resources, which with which to resist their oppression. That's the question. Not that the intention was different, is that it operates differently,
mm-hmm.
right? And the capacity of black people to resist is different. And consequently, in the North, you end up with a series of laws, right, that as we push through World War II into the present, but this stuff begins in the 20s and teens,
mm-hmm.
you begin to get legislation that's for human, human rights commissions are created. You get a legislation that allow black people to enter any public facility, right? Because the 1875 Civil Rights Act, which is the precursor to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, right? Which followed the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which Andrew Johnson vetoed, and it had to be passed over his head, that these things create greater, because of the legislation, whites have to behave differently,
mm-hmm.
right? Have to be more controlled and less inhumane. That allows black people to operate in spaces that where they can create greater political opportunities in the North than in the South, right?
Because
mm-hmm. you would think, you know, even today, the overwhelming majority of black people live in the South, but it's only been since the 65 Voting Rights Act that you get large numbers of black elected officials coming out of the South,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's those kinds of phenomena that you have to talk about in understanding the impact of this great migration that occurs during the teens, that helps set the stage for the national black community that emerges and has impact and has the capacity to wage a civil rights movement in the 1950s and to morph that into something much more meaningful, of course, the Black Power Movement, which is where we actually go back and look at things other than, right, 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voting Rights Act, and begin to look deeper and start talking about, well, what actually leads to the transformation in terms of acquisition of jobs, acquisition of education. Then we're going to find that those things have more to do with the second half of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
Black Power part, than they have to do with the first part of that.
Yes.
I was just wondering
you got to read the literature.
What your take would be on the idea that World War II, especially black Americans' participation in the war effort, plus would give a moral impetus, you know, like A. Philip Randolph was able to go in and get Roosevelt to desegregate the defense
factories. But that wasn't around a question of morality, nor was it in recognition of African American service in World War II. That was because he threatened to bring 100,000 black people into Washington,
well, yeah, D.C., which would look really bad.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying right there. That's part of it.
Yeah.
But then after that, there's also, you know, more of an impetus there. Plus, you had competition with the Soviet Union and the rest of the Eastern Bloc, and the United States is running all over the world about democracy and human rights, and it also helped. You know, all workers in the United States, too,
it does,
in that matter.
Let's not get to the point where we ever begin to argue that external conditions have greater weight than internal conditions. See, a lot of people take the argument that you just laid out, and they would put forward a thesis that essentially says that it's the Cold War that creates the conditions for the civil rights movement.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say that it's an influence.
Let me make my point.
Yeah.
Of course, it's an influence. The question is, what is the category of the influence? Right?
So quantifying the influence, basically.
Yeah, we got to weigh mm-hmm. these things.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not being a reductionist here. I'm somebody who's really into culture and how culture changes and changes people.
Yeah, but
and I'm saying that that's a part
really
of it.
Isn't just a cultural argument.
No,
I'm agree with you that it's.
I'm not saying that people don't have agency.
When you raise the international question in the way in which you raised it, the suggestion is that it is a consequence of international pressure. It's a question of morality. The U.S. doesn't want to look bad. That's part of it, and it's the minor part. The dominant part is African-American agency on the ground that forces conditions. Look,
well, that's what I was trying to say.
The Soviet Union never came out in a critical statement of the U.S. without black people demanding that. Even that statement that Mao Zedong writes in 1963, and even his follow-up statement, right, in terms of black folks' rights, those are consequences of what the struggle had done. The struggle had become so important. It's like right now. Why are Palestinians, why are other people now in Europe thinking about what's happening in the U.S. And saying things positively about what African Americans are doing? It's because the people have taken to the streets in Ferguson and around the country, as David was showing with during the news segment. And because of the weight of the struggle here, other people can feel comfortable to speak out against the U.S. empire.
Well, see, I understand that. I was just saying that it was an influence. I'm not saying that it's taking away agency from white American workers who were union members and struck. Right. All union members, even though that did it. What I'm saying is it helps, gives a little bit more of a political wedge, and it worked for more than people, but you had to have the agency. You just couldn't sit back and do nothing.
You had to have effective agency.
Yeah.
See, there's always resistance. People don't accept oppression. They resist in multiple ways every day, every second of every day. The question is that it must be effective. When you are effectively waging a struggle, you can get solidarity from people outside of your country, you can get solidarity from people inside the country. The more intense the African-American struggle is, the more likely we are to draw allies from the white community, Latinos, Asian-Americans, and other folks. When our struggle is weak, we don't get support.
Well, that's correct. That's an interactive thing.
It's an interactive thing. Mm-hmm. So we always must begin with the internal question.
Right.
What is it people are doing for themselves, right? How they are pushing the struggle. And then we talk about the links, because you can only build those links, right, through struggle, through your own capacity to push. You have to go out and reach out for solidarity. People don't come and say, we want to help you.
Not unless you made a big splash.
That's
what
I said, yeah,
in the
splash.
Pool.
And so the point is, and again, is I'm not dealing with you, the individual.
Yeah.
I'm dealing with that argument, because I often hear that argument, even from progressive black folks. There's a theory out there where they think that the African-American situation rises and falls based on the extent to which international actors speak out on our behalf.
Really?
I've seen a theory. I've said in
No, I've never noticed that. I wouldn't even...
Well, you don't go to African American Studies conferences, okay?
I wasn't even saying.
I've been at an African American History Conference, the major one, where a major scholar said that the international dimension has always been primary, and talks about slaves escaping into Georgia, escaping from Georgia to Florida when the Spanish controlled Florida, and that we needed to spend that. Talks about the role of the French, and on and on and on. And there's a theory of African American history that privileges the international. I'm simply saying that. First of all, no theory of history can be monocausal.
Right.
It's overdetermined, right? Things are overdetermined. Secondly, as a good Marxist, we know that we study the internal first, not the external, right? That's why Marxism is a theory of production and not a theory of exchange, right? So we start with what people do for themselves and what they do to then build solidarity. We don't start with that international, because that context, we can't control that context, right?
Mm-hmm.
That rare in history have you had two rivals, right, that shapes world history. Oftentimes you have one dominant power. And if we take that position that it's the international determinant, then what the hell are black folks to do today? What the hell are Latinos to do today? Because the U.S. is hegemonic at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are resistances, South America, right? They're electing a lot
of leftist
government.
Well, okay, now one of my points is that I think that both the American labor movement and various other liberation movements have had greater difficulty since there is no international rival.
That's right.
You know, since like the 1980s.
No, I agree.
You know, but I'm not saying that it's determinant, but I'm saying that it has an influence.
You're not.
That's what I wanted to move to is more now and how since...
And I was going to say one last thing. Know. If anything, I've seen it work the other way, to where black struggle in the United States has inspired...
Martin Luther King. Oh, they're getting money from Russia, the communists, so they're bad. No, that happened.
The African-American struggle, civil rights and black power, have impacted the rest of the world in deep ways. Mm-hmm. In terms of organization, in terms of tactics, as well as in terms of as cultural symbols.
Yes. Right?
Well, I think I was thinking about this because something that Paul played on News from Neptune. Mm-hmm. And folks, if you've not listened to News from Neptune, you might want to check that out before our show on Saturdays.
Okay.
But, he was playing something back, and they were also talking about the Soviet Union. Mm. Since we don't have anything like that, we have a hegemonic power, it's just that little more difficult. And also, folk music, Bob Dylan and also rockers like the Beatles really helped out in the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, but they didn't really liberate anybody, and it would have been done without them.
Yeah, most of these British 60s bands were inspired by the blues music.
Yeah, the struggle the Delta. Of American...
Yeah, but what I was going to say is what's amazing is how much the what I've seen is that working the other way of opposite what these various conferences are trying to claim, which it seems like a very disempowering tactic, hopeless
it's
one.
It's not the conferences, it's the individuals.
Individuals, okay. Individuals. To where it not only helped inspire movements in Africa, in Latin America, but also in Northern Ireland. I know people who are from Northern Ireland originally who live in Chicago, who are in their like 60s. Late 50s through their 60s, who said that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, but especially Malcolm X and the Black Panther Party were great inspirations to them besides their, historical Irish, resistance fighters. So if anything, I see the opposite, that happening. So, but anyway, wow, you know what? We're just about, probably want to wind this up because I don't know where to go, except we got to say this. We got to say something about what's happening today. You've seen, like you mentioned in your talk at the minimum wage thing about how the organizing of the 1930s, helped all working people, mm-hmm. and African Americans included, to where they could eventually get middle class incomes, buy homes. But then you had a deindustrialization coming up later in the 1990s. It kind of started before then, actually late 70s, really hit hard, in the 90s. Right. So we come today to where Detroit is, oh my God, I don't know what else to say besides that, except a whole new, whole program on that, which I wonder what your opinion is the connection between all this going on with deindustrialization, fewer good jobs. I mean, yeah, you got lots of low-paid service sector jobs out there with no benefits. Huge rates, nevertheless, even with all those low-wage service sector jobs, huge unemployment rates with African-Americans. You have large unemployment rates among college grads, even. I guess what this is all leading into, Sundiata, is how do you see things, like with all the police killings of African-American youth? Is this tie in somehow? Is the ruling class that threatened by the potential of resistance, especially from the African American community? They have to do overkill, these are just some random thoughts I'm throwing at you here that I've kind of bounced back and forth, as things have unfolded.
Wait a minute, man. I'm sorry, but you're saying like I see this, but is it like what somebody like Rockefeller calls up the police?
No,
you're saying the ruling class.
Well,
it seems more like something with the police themselves.
Well, okay.
That's a good question.
I think
the economic interest. Okay.
And this would be more of a cultural thing because it's not some ruling class person calling up the local police
and saying it isn't.
People.
Let's throw this out here and listen.
Let me respond to
Yes,
it.
Sure.
That's the best way to do this.
Yeah.
First and foremost, mm-hmm. that there is indeed a structural problem that capital is caught up in. The transition to global financialized capital has led to, capital likes to move from developed areas to underdeveloped areas because they can get land more cheaply,
labor cheaper.
You're thinking about cutting costs so they can maximize their surplus value. So that explains the flight from mm-hmm. the U.S. and the flight to different sections in the U.S. from what had been the historical development, i.e. the flight from the Midwest and the industrial centers to the rural South and da-da-da-da, and, of course, out of the country. That context, right, there's no way to say that deindustrialization has not led to the creation of jobs that we that have often been referred to as McDonald's Mick jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're service jobs and they don't have benefits or they don't have enough benefits and they don't pay much and many of the times they're part time, and that has been a general trend in the society for the last 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is the nature of capital. Okay? Now for African Americans, it hasn't simply been deindustrialization. It's also been deproletarianization. What I mean by that is the work leaves. The black people have been isolated and marginalized from work. So when we talk about a place like somebody was saying St. Louis, well, they didn't mean St. Louis, they meant Clayton, right? Clayton Galleria was shut down. That's not St. Louis.
Okay.
Okay, St. Louis is a particular city. Clayton is a white elite enclave that abuts St. Louis.
Okay.
Okay. There, in places like Clayton that become more isolated, right, what we've witnessed as we've seen decline in wages, as we've seen capital flight and the flight of jobs, African-American communities have become poor, right? White communities have become richer. And as that divide has happened, we've seen a resegregation of the society, particularly in terms of schooling and residential,
mm-hmm.
right? Apartheid has increased, okay? Now, policing those spaces, right? This is where I'm going to the police.
Okay.
Because I think it's wrong to not think about the police in relation to capital, because the laws that they enforce and the policies that they enforce are those things that those things that strengthen and stabilize the existing status quo,
mm-hmm.
right? The existing set of relationships,
mm-hmm.
racial, class, and otherwise, right? And so when we think about the stop and frisk in New York, why do you need to stop people and frisk them unless you feel that they're in spaces that they shouldn't be? Why do you need to have such a massive growth in incarceration that is largely racialized as blacks and Latinos? But even when we talk about blacks and Latinos, right, African Americans constitute 48% of the 2.2 million incarcerated. Latinos constitute 15.5% of those. Now, there's definitely deep weight on the Latino side, but 15% to 48% is a fucking difference. It's a difference. Okay? And so we have to understand that these things, all they have disparate impact racially and in class terms. Now, so the police are enforcing this new separation. That's why they do stop and frisk. Why are black people being killed? You know, one, we don't know that police are killing more black people than they used to,
mm-hmm.
right? But I feel like it's an increase since the 60s. You know, I can't talk about the turn of the century, right?
Right.
Okay? I mean, I shudder at what those numbers probably look like,
mm-hmm.
okay? But since the 60s, it certainly feels like there's an increase. And there's no way to disconnect that from black people's more marginalized status in the society. The need, but more marginalized status, but in a time when they do have access to public space, you see? There was a time when you couldn't go into Macy's. Now you can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Oh, sorry.
And so, as the society has been resegregating, the police are asked to patrol those boundaries, and they adopt policies that are primed at putting large numbers of people who in jail who otherwise would simply be on the streets without a job,
mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, and of course one can talk crime, but crime has been going down.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Crime has right. been dropping rapidly in this country for the last 2 decades. So, you know, kill the bullshit there.
Yeah.
Right. Let's right. talk seriously. So it's not about stopping crime.
Not like Giuliani talking the other day.
Yeah, yeah,
did
yeah,
you see
yeah,
that?
Yeah. It's not
that
about stopping crime, because if it was about stopping crime, then they would be able to produce, when they stop and frisk all these kids, they there would be some illegal action that they're mm-hmm. engaged in, and that hasn't been the case. So how do we get to these police killings? At the same time, the black people have been marginalized from work, and the society has been resegregating, right? There has been a greater devaluation of African Americans as a people, especially black men.
Well, Wilson, he literally demonized. He said he was a demon.
That's right.
He yeah.
Wilson went there.
That was incredible.
There, okay. And so that notion now that black people, the black body, is seen as disposable. So if you can't incarcerate it, then you're going to react to it in a way to put it down. That's the understanding of police brutality. And all we have to do is look at their policies. The use of force policies that this is, like in St. Louis, the one that I should say Missouri, their old use of force policy that they still act off of, that says you can shoot a fleeing suspect, right? That's inhumane. You only do that if you see people as disposable. So there's no way to separate the disposableness of African Americans at this historical moment mm-hmm. from the transitions and transformations in capital. And if I can, and I know I'm doing a long rant, but I got to say something about protests because of that silly editorial that was in the News Gazette the other day, and because every time I hear someone on television, they're talking about the violence.
Mm-hmm.
The violence is that every 28 hours, a black person is killed by the police, and many of these are murders.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, out now.
First, second degree, they're murders.
Yeah.
Okay? The response of people to burn things, to shoot at police, these are tactics, right? And when we're talking about tactics, it's not a moral question, okay? The question is it effective?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's about power, you know.
Okay, so... Now, if you're asking me, was the burning of those buildings, shooting at some cops, the confrontation with the cop, which were cop-initiated, right, was that effective in pursuing the interests of African Americans? Here's what I'm going to say. In the last week, Emerson and three other major corporations that are either located in Ferguson or located near Ferguson have announced that they're going to begin to hire black folk.
They nope, hire really? More. Interesting.
Study the history of the 1960 urban right. rebellions. And the real crisis is this, that in order for black people to get a modicum of fair treatment, we have to take to the streets in non-institutionalized ways that we often are forced, right, to do these things. And then understand the consequence. It's one thing if you're telling me that people, when they say they're burning their own property, they don't own those stores. Very few of those stores are owned
right.
by black folks. What's the nature of that store to the black community? Is it a convenience store? Is it one of the predatory payday lenders? Is it one of those furniture stores that's got like 29% interest?
Or another
how do they treat people?
The rental.
You understand? In other words, if something burns, that means the people mm-hmm. made a decision to burn this place and not that place.
Right.
What did they make the decision on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So these are forms of resistance, whether we like it or not.
And whether they're effective or not, that's the question, too.
Whether or not they're effective. That's
yes.
the only question.
Mm-hmm.
See, the problem with white people in America... I don't think white people in Europe had this problem. I think it's white people in America.
No, like May Day there.
There's an inherent...
every year.
Because U.S. history is such a falsification of anything that happened, that there's an arrogance and a hypocrisy. So, for example, the same people who want to condemn Ferguson, they stand up and put their hand over their heart when you start talking about the Sons of Liberty and you start talking about the American Revolution. Didn't that thing begin with a riot? Or what they call a riot?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's how all forms of resistance, it begins inchoate. Right? And then it has to get organized.
Well, like these, you know, like Southerners are real patriotic, but aren't they the ones who committed treason and revolution against the... Yeah. But they always act real patriotic all the time.
I just needed that space to.
That was great. I mean, I threw out a whole mess there, and you organized it real excellently. Yes. And I acknowledge that this is, it seems like economically and, of course, police violence, that the African-American community, the poor African-American community is getting hit. They're taking the brunt of it. But you also have, of course, Latinos and poor whites, working class whites that are trying to struggle. So, I mean, and capitalism is, it's all part of, isn't it kind of the root?
Difference. Yes. So, that's one thing we have to understand is that when it's going to divide.
Yes.
If we can find a basis to divide workers so we can get lower costs, more docile labor, pit folks. That's the nature of that system.
Historically as well as contemporary.
It is the character of the system. So while I try and talk about black people in terms of particularity, because I don't like to be general.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're best when we're very specific and particular, right? So phrases like people of color, that works in certain contexts.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, right, in some ways it illuminates the difference economically, politically, socially, and cultural in terms of representation between whites and Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, American Indians. But it also masks the differences amongst African Americans, Asian Americans, and it masks class differences amongst whites, right? And so sometimes we have to be more precise with our language. Sometimes we use these glosses in order to try and speak to unity, but real unity has to be built on the basis of understanding the realities and the consciousness at that particular moment of the people you're trying to unite, right? So obviously, given my politics, I'm for solidarity, but I believe that solidarity demands reciprocity. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, of course.
Okay, so it can't be a situation where people don't want to talk about the real hardcore reality. So I'll throw something out. We'll just leave it at that. We have to talk about reciprocity.
We have
to talk about building unity, and we have to talk about understanding that we're not, some people might be engaged in a moral struggle, and I guess to some degree I'm engaged in a struggle that has moral elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, I see that we're engaged in a political struggle, a struggle for the freedom, for liberation for African-American people, for self-determination. And we're engaged in a struggle to transform this society from one that is deeply oppressive around all kinds of social relations, right? Race, class, gender, sexual, wide range of ways in which the United States society is deeply oppressive of folk. And obviously I'm opposed to oppression, right? But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to begin my analysis with the plight of the African-American people.
Absolutely. I mean, this is your heritage. I mean, it's like, I think, a lot of us can learn from all of our heritages.
That's
because,
right.
I get into conversations a lot. First of all, a lot of people, myself included, don't like the word white. I mean, we don't really, I have nothing in common with those Southerners or other people that came. I mean, we came from different ethnic backgrounds. But the thing is everybody here, forced Africans were forced into slavery, indentured service. We all had our struggles. And even when someone like myself concedes that despite no matter how hard, like, say, my ancestors suffered, stories that have passed down from generations in my family, my grandmother, who was born in 1890, always said as much as we, hard as we, our people had it, the Africans and the Indians suffered much worse.
Well, Dave, the thing
so
is,
we can, what I'm getting at here is we all can learn from our heritage that we all have the same oppressor.
Yeah.
And we all have our uniqueness. Our cultures have uniqueness and we have commonalities as far as what's happened.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my nutshell thing on your take, and I guess that's where you're coming from too, in a way, maybe.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Well, something I'm looking at is like, okay, all these people, mentioned it earlier, and I wasn't talking about 1680. I was talking later in history when I was talking about Germans, Italians, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody pretty much the United States up till, well, it's still not, I guess, maybe with Asians and Mexicans, but all of these groups, and there are a lot of differences between Greeks, say, and Swedes.
Well, of course, sure.
Swedes were not even considered white when they first came, but all of those groups were able to become white. I noticed a difference on construction crews between whites' attitudes about their black co-workers and their Mexican co-workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the Mexicans will become white as well as the Asians. And it's just this
50% of
terrible.
All Latino immigrants into this country check the box.
They're white, but speak Spanish. Right.
Right, because.
George Zimmerman.
Ethnicity.
Yes. Yeah, George Zimmerman. It's a language thing.
You have African Latinos. You have
The president of Mexico looks like he's from Sweden. They're Spanish.
Northern Spanish.
Indian blood.
And I.
You even have Asian and Africa. You know, of course, in Mexico, there's actually I think in the Veracruz state.
Yes. And I see the differences. This crew I've been on lately has had a lot more people that are more Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. A little spin on that story, Bill. And I had to work up in Chicago on and off for 4 years.
Yeah.
Some of the people, some of the workers up there, construction workers of European American heritage, talk bad about other European American. I mean, like they say the darn Irish or the Italians or the stupid Polish.
Yeah. My parents' generation's Catholics.
Yeah.
So
again, that's just always seemed like it's been with us. And of course, it seems like the ruling class just loves to, use this to divide us. I mean, just as everything from jokes to economic competition for jobs to basically try to keep us down,
Pollock jokes.
Yeah. we've got to end this, Sundiata, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a really fantastic, informative show. And sometime, if you feel like it, we'd love to have you back on because, I think we just barely scratched the surface on the period from World War II, the 1960s, and what's happening today. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFTN Champaign, Illinois. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.
Hey, I'm going to start a company like that. You want to go in business?
No, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror in the morning, dude. Seriously.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Trish, do you when you're working, do you have any veterans that are working there?
I do. There is a lot there. I mean, they are amazing guys. To hear these stories, they've gone through so much. It's amazing. And then they work at Walmart.
For $8 or $9 an hour, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I got to tell you guys, Wally, I need to talk to you about our vets because we're going to talk about that a lot on the radio. But I don't think the veteran community knows about this.
I reached out to Vietnam Veterans of America, and they haven't responded back to me yet. We've only been, I'd say, getting together for the past 4 or 5 months, but this Black Friday is taking all my time. So December 1st, I'm going to hit the books hard, draft up a letter for Walmart, and ask them these questions.
Well, Wally, here's what I want to say to you. As soon as you get settled, you get ready to do this, we're going to help you get the word out there because this is insidious. I mean, you guys have enough of a battle trying to get Walmart to pay you a decent rate. I mean, it's not going to kill the company to pay you $15 an hour. I mean, it's not going to kill the company at all. It's going to have no impact on the company or their operations or their profit margins. I mean, they do it all the time over at Costco. They're paying people over there $18-$20 an hour.
Yeah, and there's so many studies out there that I don't have in front of me, but if for them to pay $15 an hour, the dividend, or if the Waltons would give back their dividends for a year or even a month, they could afford to pay $15 an hour for the whole year for everybody. Something to that effect.
Yeah, Trish, let me ask you a question. You've been working there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
In that 2 years' time, what did you start off working at?
780. I work now for 860. It's a 40-cent raise each year.
Wow. And where does that cap out at? You know, I mean, how many years do you have to work there to get a pension?
Do they even give out pensions? I mean,
not for anybody.
It's hard to say because there's guys that have, there's a technician that works with me. He's been working there for a lot of years. And, I mean, he's just got a little plaque and everything. But, I mean, after so long, they have to cap you off. I don't know how much that would be or anything, but they will at some point cap you off.
Oh, I'm sure.
So you don't make more than, like, what, $12, $13 an hour?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Trish. What do you think the profit is for your store every year?
Last year we made about $84 million.
And how many people do you have working at that store?
Around maybe 180, maybe up, maybe more.
So just about everybody in that store is bringing in $500,000 each, huh? Let me see if I get this right. They're working you part-time. So okay, that means there's 90 jobs there for real as opposed to 180, okay?
Right.
So that means if they're making $84 million, maza, 90 people, oh, that's about $1 million a job. And they're paying you, what, 18 grand a year?
About that, give or take.
If you can get a full-time job, right? Are you working full-time?
I am. Okay. I've been full-time for probably about a year and a half.
Would you say that you're one of the lucky ones? Ouch.
Define lucky.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so you've got a full-time job. You're making about 18 grand, and for every one of the full-time jobs at that store, that's bringing in $1 million. Hey. It's a good racket if you can get enough people to do that, huh?
There's a decent amount of people there.
Yeah. Yep.
You see the same faces almost every single day. Well, you know, 5 days a week, depending on what your schedule is.
Right. Trish, what is it you want the public to know?
That Walmart needs to treat their employees better. Not to stop, just to stop the retaliation. I mean, I work back in the automotive area, and it's sad to say that there are some part-time associates that don't get health care benefits or anything because they make less than 30 hours a week. I mean, it's sad. Like they just cut the associates that are part-time that make 30 hours a week or less, no benefits. It's like, how does that work out? Like, I mean, benefits just raise. They just increase the amounts and everything on that. And it's hard. Like, a lot of people just pay work there so they can have health care insurance. And it's not some cheap little item either. It's expensive. Like,
well, let me ask you a question. Those people that just lost their health care insurance because they're working 30 hours or less, what do they do when they get sick? What do they do if, God forbid, they have to go to the hospital?
They do what I do. I don't go. Or go on welfare. I mean, it's a sad thing to say that to work less than 30 hours and not be able to afford your normal things, like to buy healthy food or anything like that.
Wally, are you hearing this same story in different stores?
Yes, sir.
And as an organizer, and God bless you for what you're doing, man. God bless you indeed.
Thank you.
From the organizer side of this, you're seeing a lot of people in the same boat. What should the public know?
If it's not directly happening to you, just remember that all your taxes, most of your taxes is going in to subsidize Walmart, whether you might be getting cheap prices at the register, but you're paying for the health care, you're paying for the food stamps, and just remember the treatment that the workers are getting. They're being retaliated against for speaking up. And as far as Trish goes, she's my hero. This is her third strike, and she's doing nothing but kicking butt and taking names, so I'm proud of that. Basically, just wake up, America. You know, everybody thinks we're picking on Walmart, but being Walmart is the number one retailer, you know, why not go after the biggest one? Because they're setting the standards. Even though they're low, they're still setting the standards for other retails. And it's something in America that we need to change. Boost up the economy, get people off the above poverty level wages, so you don't have to depend on or make a decision, well, should I pay the bill or should I feed my kid this month?
Wally, how do we...
Just basically take it to heart that even though you don't work at Walmart, just think about the people who do and think about our veterans.
Wally, how do we find out more about our Walmart?
You can go to our Facebook page, is Our Walmart Pennsylvania, or you can go to forrespect.org and check it out.
Let me see if I get this right. Somebody will pay me $9,600 to hire a veteran. I only have to work them 4 hours at minimum wage, about $3,200. I get to keep the balance of that $9,600. Pretty sweet deal. Kind of shameful what it does to the veteran and their family, though.
Yep.
Wally, Trish, thank you very much for being with us, guys. We'll see you here very soon.
Thanks for inviting us, Charles.
We'll get you back.
Yes, thank you.
I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.
Hi, this is John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Josh Groban. 1 in 6 Americans don't know where their next meal will come from. These are our neighbors, friends, and coworkers. There's just no sugarcoating it. These people need our help. Visit feedingamerica.org/hunger to find out how you can make a difference. I'm Josh Groban, and together, we're Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is Lisa Edelstein from House. On TV, the good doctors aren't always easy to spot, but it is easy to spot the good that Barasa Ware is doing as a local health worker in Ethiopia. Every day, he helps the children of his village survive. When you help local health workers like Barasa, you're one step away from helping children survive all over the world. See where the good goes at goodgoes.org and find out all the ways you can help the good go further. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
I make learning a privilege, not a chore, and frustration a tool, not an obstacle. I'm a teacher. I make more.
Make more. Teach. Visit teach.org. Brought to you by Teach and the Ad Council.
Welcome to the Maya Miguel Challenge. Meet Maya and the gang.
Oh, hi. I'm Maya.
Maya and her friends want you to get up and play because it's always more fun to be active.
Let's get started.
Just go to letsmove.gov and look for Maya and Miguel. You'll find tons of fun activities that'll help keep you healthy and active. Whether you play sports, run, dance, or jump in place, just get up and play at least an hour a day. Take the Maya and Miguel Challenge today at letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Take this time to breathe deeply and close your eyes. Right now, you're completely in control. Unlike the time you and your son played basketball and you attempted to slam dunk. Or when you tried removing those raccoons from the basement. Concentrate on the soothing sound of my voice. Release the memory of when you wrestled with that beehive in your son's treehouse. Let go of the time you thought that skunk was a cat. Or when you pulled into the garage with your son's bike on top of the car. Deep breaths. deep breaths.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
While cutting molding with a 12-inch dual-compound miter saw, while holding a newborn baby in your arms, when face-to-face with a congregation of alligators, with the ball in your hands and the entire freaking season on the line.
There are a million places you'd never consider texting, so why would you do it while driving? NASCAR driver Casey Kane here, asking you to please stop the text, and together we can stop the wrecks.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Get the message at stoptextstopwrecks.org.
It's about the work. Work we're proud of. Work that provides the energy that powers America. Work that means our communities are stronger, better, for our families, our neighbors, for everyone. Just like you, members of the United Mine Workers of America are on the job, every day, working hard. It's what we do, and it makes America a better place. The United Mine Workers of America, working families, just like yours.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. We appreciate that very much. Joining us now on the phone, we have Stuart Acuff, organizer extraordinaire. Stuart, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Charles. It's so good to be with you and your listeners today. I always appreciate it, and I always appreciate that great compliment you give me. Thank you very much. It's great to be with you. And going into Thanksgiving, we have another thing to be thankful for. Last week, Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Energy, which owned the Upper Big Branch Upper Big Branch mine, in which 29 mine workers were killed, was indicted, and I am so happy and grateful that this arrogant bee was indicted by the U.S. grand jury and will have to face retribution and accountability for his negligence and his willful arrogance in the death of 29 mine workers. I don't know if you remember that explosion, but at the time, the mine wasn't adequately ventilated, and everybody who worked in the mine, everybody who didn't work in the mine, everybody in management, knew it was an explosion waiting to happen, and finally he's been indicted. And the arrogance and the disdain for us as working people, the lack of concern for our lives, the lack of concern for our families, the sense that we can be thrown away as people is one of the things that we're struggling against so hard in the country today.
Stuart, that explosion was horrific, and it could have been solved by just following standard safety protocols.
Protocols.
Right.
That's right. Mine Safety and Health Administration protocols. Absolutely. That's exactly right, Charles. Wouldn't that happen?
And it's my understanding that there were other things that were brought up. It's my understanding that during the autopsies, it was determined that all of the miners were exhibiting various stages of black lung. We know how to stop black lung. It's a disease. It's an industrial disease that that can be stopped. You know, there should be no reason why anybody in this country should ever have black lung. It's an economic disease because the non-union mines won't take the time to buy the equipment or do the training, so on and so forth. You know, and I've talked to Phil Smith about this, the United Mine Workers, and he said that their training teams would be willing to come into the non-union mines just to teach those miners how to use the equipment properly so they don't get black lung. And the non-union mines won't let them in to do that.
No.
For free.
No, of course they won't. Because they don't care about the lives of those non-union miners. They don't care about the lives of the union miners. The union is the only thing that forces them to care about their lives. It's horrific and it's incredibly corrosive to our economy and to our nation that we now have a class of owners where the wealth is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, and they have no concern about the good of the country or the good of the people who produce that wealth.
Heck, Stuart, they don't even pretend they care these days. You know, and
no.
That's an unfortunate thing. You know, I find it just absolutely incredulous. And then we have these politicians that are out there defending these business practices,
right.
You know, saying that the administration and MSHA and all these people that are concerned about, you know, black lung and all this kind of, oh, it's just a war on coal. Coal miners, you know, poor coal mine owners, you know, why is everybody picking on them?
Well, the truth of the matter is they have killed, I'm talking about the energy companies now, they have been in the process of killing their best advocates for 30 years as they shut down union mines and open up non-union mines in the same seam of coal, one county over, and de-unionize the mining industry. They are slowly killing their best advocates for the use of coal as part of our energy mix, and that's the United Mine Workers. It's an example of how short-sighted and stupid those who control the wealth of the country are. I just read a study that just blew me away. It's now the top 100th of 1% control over 40% of the nation's wealth. And that is just amazing to me. It's no longer the 1%. It's the 100th of 1% control over 40% of the nation's wealth. And that's the Don Blankenships of the world. It's the Walton family. It's the Koch brothers. And they are free to use that money to influence elections and to influence our friends. They've now given, in the last election period that we had records for, which is 2012, they gave four times as much money to Democrats as labor unions did. I mean... change is going to come, and let's hope it's peaceful, and let's hope it's feet on the ground, marching for change, voting for change, but change has got to come. You cannot sustain this level of disdain for your people without change coming at some point.
Absolutely. Stuart, we've got to get going. We appreciate you being with us today. How do we get a hold of you if we have any questions?
The best way is my email, Acuff, A-C-U-F-F, dot Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, at gmail.com. The second best way is to check out...